Hello, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair with Lynn Curtis of the Club's Arts Forum and your organizer for this program. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure, great pleasure, to introduce my friend and our distinguished speaker, Dr. Robert Mieko Rosenbaum, neuropsychologist, psychotherapist, Zen teacher, credentialed mountaineer, and a senior teacher in the Taoist practice, Dayan Qigong, and author of Walking the Way, 81 Zen Encounters with the Tao, Te Ching, and Zen and the Heart of Psychotherapy. There's seats up front. Bob is co-editor with Barry Majid of the Book of Essays, What's Wrong with Mindfulness and What Isn't? Zen Perspectives, in which they and other authors examine critical concerns and creative engagement of Zen experience with mindfulness practice. The Marketplace, Mindfulness Myths, Fantasies and Facts, Solitude and Mindfulness in the Arts, Feminism and Zen Liberation, Western Buddhism, all consider the topic. And so I think Bob starts off the book with the Zen in America question of universal mindfulness. Be careful what you wish for. Bob Rosenbaum.
Thanks very much, Anne. It's very nice to be here. It's good to see friends, family, people interested in this topic. I want to preface my talk by saying, although the title of the book is What's Wrong with Mindfulness and What Isn't is in smaller letters, and although my talk will be mostly on some issues which concern me and my fellow authors about some possible trends that we're seeing with the popularization of mindfulness, I want to emphasize mindfulness is wonderful. My sister is a senior mindfulness teacher. She was with Jon Kabat-Zinn from the very beginning at the Center for Mindfulness and helped him develop the program. Some of you might have even taken classes with her, Ilana Rosenbaum. There's no question that mindfulness and what mindfulness teachers have done have benefited many, many people. But as Anne said, universal mindfulness, when something gets really, really popular, you can have sometimes unexpected effects. Before I get into the meat of the talk, my sweetheart, Jean Courtney, said, you know, before you talk, some of the folks might not have much background in mindfulness. So here's the 1 minute quick history of how mindfulness developed in this country and what it's basically about. So there were precursors. In the 1950s, we had the Zen and the Beat folks. We had TM, Transcendental Meditation, the Relaxation Response, Herbert Benson. But really, things got started when Jon Kabat-Zinn wrote Full Catastrophe Living, started the Center for Mindfulness, started the program in mindfulness-based stress reduction at UMass. Folks started... Jack Kornfield wrote A Path with Heart, the Insight or Vipassana Meditation Societies, started on the East Coast and West Coast. Both John and Jack and all of the folks involved in these centers had extensive training in mindfulness in the Theravadan tradition in Southeast Asia. They made some conscious decisions to adapt it to the United States situation, and they were able to promulgate it throughout the 1990s, helped by a number of trends. we had the advent of complementary medicine, yoga became popular, positive psychology became popular, and certainly the rise of multitasking, computers do more, led people to seek something which could help them calm down a bit. And there was this burgeoning of research. You can see it went from nearly nothing in the early 90s to huge amounts. Every year there's tons and tons of research, some of which I review in one of the chapters of the book, but I'm probably not going to review the research here. And pretty soon, you had mindfulness starting in medical centers, in psychology, in government, in corporations. You had places like Google, General Mills, Monsanto, of all places, creating mindfulness programs for their employees. You have the military offering mindfulness programs for their staff. So it became huge, and pretty soon everybody, students, teachers, police, CEOs, nurses, addicts, lawyers, prisoners, I mean, you name it, everyone's doing mindfulness. You can now get apps for mindfulness. They've been downloaded millions of times by people around the world. It's big. So what is mindfulness? Well, we'll get into that. But the four foundations of mindfulness traditionally are about contemplating the body in the body, feelings in the feelings, consciousness in consciousness, which sometimes gets relegated to being aware of thoughts and feelings, which is not quite the same thing. And probably the most common way that mindfulness is taught is in mindfulness of the breath. The Satipatthana Sutra starts with contemplating the body in the body. A person arouses mindfulness in the breath, trains herself with the thought, calming the activity of the body, I shall breathe in, calming the activity of the body, I shall breathe out. This slide is courtesy of my sister. Probably the most common form of mindfulness is you sit down, you get quiet, you notice your breath, your mind wanders, you refocus attention, and you keep cycling around. Okay. So that's mindfulness, but really, what is mindfulness? It's used as a method for stress reduction, a method for meditation, a path for personal happiness, a method for controlling thoughts and feelings, for training the brain, a method of psychotherapy. And if there's one thing I'd like you to take from this talk, it's basically that mindfulness is not a method. It's a way of being. It's a way of living. And that can get lost when it's taught as a technique. So the question is, when mindfulness is taught as a technique, does it, well, I think it does. It runs a danger of turning into one more commodity, of becoming a trademarked brand, and actually some mindfulness teachers have trademarked their particular versions of mindfulness, and it can be co-opted by a commercial consumerist society and become a matter of individual accomplishment. That's the concern. So I thought it would be interesting if we went back to the question of what's mindfulness and take John's definition, which is probably the most common definition, paying attention in a particular way on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally. Any of you here, either mindfulness teachers or practitioners? Okay, so you're probably familiar with that definition. I want to take each piece of it because John very purposefully took the mindfulness tradition and adapted it to medical clinics in ways that he thought would be accessible to Westerners. But in so doing, some of the traditional background he very consciously put to one side. So let's take the first section, paying attention on purpose. Well, that sounds sensible. But traditionally, Gil Fronsdale is a Zen teacher who didn't feel satisfied with Zen, so he went on and became a mindfulness practitioner and teacher. He combines the two of them. He also became a Buddhist scholar. I believe he has a doctorate in Buddhist studies. And he notes that traditionally, sati, which is the word that we translate not so well as mindfulness, had a different meaning than how it's usually taught today. It's usually taught as an active practice of directed attention. You choose to be mindful of something. But in the sutras, sati is a faculty. It's a natural human faculty that everyone has. It's not a mental activity that you intentionally engage in. It's a state of receptive attentiveness, not requiring self-conscious effort. We're a very effortful society. That's the problem in many ways. And because sati and mindfulness is a faculty, basically, traditionally, one acquired or one became more mindful not through doing a meditation. Mindfulness meditation is only about 100 years old. It dates back to the late 1800s, early 1900s. Instead, you acquire mindfulness basically through right action, through living a certain kind of life, and then mindfulness naturally comes forth because you're not muddying it. So when you stop being so concerned with doing it on purpose and you start getting into less doing and more being, I mean, that's kind of the heart of what mindfulness is about. And it relates back to a core value of the Tao Te Ching, which informs a lot of this practice. I do not act, and people transform themselves. I stay in stillness, and people settle themselves. I have no business, and people prosper themselves. I let go of desire, and people return to themselves, simply natural, like uncarved wood. Really, mindfulness is about being just natural, and we've lost touch with that in a lot of our daily life. So Gill, in his chapter in this book, says once he understood that mindfulness was itself an activity of the mind, he felt a desire to even allow that activity to become still. He talks about having to let go of mindfulness, and he trusted this movement of letting go. And that the mind, even letting go of knowing, we say not knowing is most intimate. And at some point when the mind was very quiet, he was surprised to see everything he identified as a mental activity, mental construction just ceased. There was no actual seeing, even awareness disappeared. And he found the experience to be life-changing, more beautiful and more satisfying than anything he had experienced before. So I thought it might be nice to give you just a taste of that, perhaps, with this little meditation adapted from Ezra Beda, more being, less doing. You can do this with your eyes open. You can do this with your eyes closed. But if you just take a few moments and say to yourself, breathing into the heart, at just this moment, there's no one in particular you have to be. Breathing into the heart at just this moment, there's nothing you have to do. Breathing into the heart at just this moment, just being. If you inhale and breathe into the heart at just this moment, you don't have to be the person who you think you are. Breathe into the heart at just this moment. There's nothing you have to do. You don't have to meditate. Breathing into the heart at just this moment. Just being. Is there a purpose to being? Do you need a purpose? Do trees need a purpose? Do children? So, purpose. Well, yeah, it's good to do things on purpose. It's good to have right intention. That's part of the Buddhist path. It's also good to let go of it. Let's take the next piece of the definition. In the present moment. So the present moment, we've all heard, you know, be here now. When I was in college, I read Baba Ram Das's Be Here Now, and I said, yes, that's what I want. And I spent the next year meditating, sitting down there trying to be here now. And I'd go, okay, now. Oh, no, that's a little late. Now. No, now, now, now. The Diamond Sutra reminds us it's impossible to clutch hold of past mind. We know the past is gone. It's impossible to seize hold of future mind. We know the future's not here yet. But here's the kicker. It's impossible to clasp hold of present mind. The present cannot be grasped. Which leaves us with the question, well, what time do you practice it? What time are you being mindful in? Ahe Dogen, the founder of Zen in the 1200s, said that time itself is all, time itself is being, all being is time. And the point is, time's not separate from you. He said, the mind arises in this moment, a moment arises in this mind. This is the understanding that the self is time. Or I like to rephrase it. You are the time of your life. Time expresses itself through you as surely as it expresses itself through the strata of the Grand Canyon and the evolution of each animal and each plant. So just to kind of shake the idea of, well, let's be in the moment. Good idea, but what does it mean? Well, the last part of the definition is to be aware non-judgmentally. And this is certainly very important. Suspend critical analysis, pay attention, just pay attention, be aware without comparing, categorizing, or criticizing. And an ancient text, the Xinxin Ming, which translates as faith in mind, says, the burdensome practice of judging brings annoyance and weariness. When attachment and aversion are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. There's a saying, in attachment, flowers fall, and in aversion, weeds spread. Just let go of attachment and aversion. If you make the smallest distinction, however, heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. So if you wish to see the truth, hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. So this kind of mindfulness asks us to let go of all of our likes and dislikes. Not exactly the way it's always taught. So it's seeing things as they are, without preconceptions, without imposing ideas. But as my friend Alan Sanauke points out, there's a difference between acting non-judgmentally and not using one's judgment. And he insists that mindfulness must contain the live fire of moral activity and wisdom. Now, Robert Scharf, who's a scholar of Buddhism in at UC Berkeley, has a chapter in the book, points out that sati entails the proper discrimination of the moral valence of phenomena as they arise. And Buddhism talks about right action, right living. So the term sati has a sense of recollecting, bearing in mind the virtuous dharmas, which is why mindfulness was traditionally always taught in context with precepts, moral, ethical precepts. And without that preceptual, ethical basis, we can run into problems. So just to show you, there's many versions of the precepts. They're fairly standard. I vow to live and be lived for the benefit of all beings. Sounds kind of nice. The devil is in the details on all of this. Some friends of mine wrote their wedding vows according to these precepts, and I think it's very important to make the precepts your own. So they took each precept and made it into a wedding vow. I particularly like they're taking the vow, I vow not to be avaricious, and vowing to each other, I vow not to keep anything from you, but to give you all that I have to offer. Isn't that nice? Yeah, that's mindful. So Alan goes on to say, in terms of mindfulness must contain the live fire of moral activity, he acknowledges corporate environments can be pressure cookers. And so you practice meditation, mindfulness. It's good to be able to take a breath and get a little space. But if you teach people mindfulness without any attention to the context in which they're working or doing things, are you asking the right questions? If you teach mindfulness in a corporation, are the people involved being asked to consider what their corporation does and make, whether it has a positive or negative social value? What's the purpose? Google has a big mindfulness program, and they explicitly say the purpose of the mindfulness program is so that people can better empathize with their customers to figure out how to sell more to them. The United States military has a program of teaching mindfulness to soldiers engaged in active, who are going to go into active combat or who've come back from it, including people who are flying drones remotely. And on the one hand, you know, you really want to help those people have some kind of buffer against the horrors that they're going to encounter. And on the other hand, frankly, I want them to be horrified when they're involved. And one kind of mindfulness is being very mindful that this is horrific rather than being calm. Mindfulness does not mean calmness. You know, teaching it as a relaxation method is fine, but it's not just a relaxation method. So if these questions aren't surfaced, Alan says in his chapter, right mindfulness is not being taught. Pretty strong statement. My sister participated in a project with the military. In this case, she was working with military spouses, helping them deal with their stress. And I don't think there was any moral question that this was very helpful for all involved. Grace Shearson has a chapter in the book in which she says right off, we don't meditate and develop awareness in order to become good meditators. We do it to help the world. She has a chapter on how her mindfulness practice helped her Zen practice. It helped her bring up gender discrimination issue in a traditional Japanese temple in Japan. And Janet Abel has a chapter on how her mindfulness practice works with her ecological activities. I really like her saying plastic bags are now one of the mindfulness tools in her toolbox. So instead of an app on her phone, the plastic bag helps her be mindful of how she's connected to everything and what effects she's having and the interactions that she's having. So non-judgmentally, well, on the one hand, when you let go of judgments, there's a way of orienting towards equanimity, and there's a kind of accepting things as they are, but it's not a state of emotional tranquility, and it's certainly not resignation, defeat, or passivity. It's greeting everything with the same mind. With the same open mind, I like to say equanimity is greeting everything with equal love. If you do that, you'll experience equanimity. It's quite wonderful. But sometimes you'll feel very sad. Sometimes you'll feel very angry. That's okay. So non-judgmentally really is everything just as it is a luminous radiance, a place for training in the way. Doesn't mean you don't react to it or deal with it. It's a place for training in the way. So some friends of mine at one Zen center, several Zen centers, have translated that into a chant. I vow to affirm what is. If there's cost, I choose to pay. If there's need, I choose to give. If there's pain, I choose to feel. If there's sorrow, I choose to grieve. When burning, I choose heat. When calm, I choose peace. When starving, I choose hunger. When happy, I choose joy. Whom I encounter, I choose to meet. What I shoulder, I choose to bear. When it's my birth, I choose to live. And when it's my death, I choose to die. Where this takes me, I choose to go. Being with what is, I respond to what is. I respond to what is. Very powerful, I think. Very powerful. Doesn't mean that you'll like it. So, traditional, most common definition, paying attention in a particular way on purpose in the present moment, perfectly fine. But I actually like Alan's definition. Mindfulness is remembering oneself and one's intention moment by moment, taking the scattered pieces of actions and awareness and recollecting them in wholeness. How do we collect the scattered bits and pieces of our lives, of our thoughts and feelings and sensations and urges, and make some whole cloth of it? So let me move on from the definition. In addition, there are three main issues with the promulgation of mindfulness in our society, and it's not confined to just the MBSR and Vipassana traditions. This is true for Zen and many other traditions as well, that Barry and our friend Mark Poiret, who unfortunately died this year before the book came out, they point out there's three issues: deracination, secularization, and instrumentalization. Well, what is that? Deracination is taking a practice from its cultural and historical roots, and that can involve, if you're not careful, a kind of disrespect. You know, there's been a lot of controversy recently about sports teams with names like, you know, the Cleveland Indians. Is that respectful or not? Sally Tisdale has a lovely piece. She says, "We've come to see each thing in the world as a piece for the taking. Religious instruction becomes a smattering of what's so often called wisdom traditions over a long weekend, with the more disturbing parts taken out. Kabbalah without orthodoxy, voodoo without sacrifice, Zen or mindfulness without morality. Remember the Satipatthana Sutra, the core foundation of mindfulness that everyone studies in mindfulness practice? Well, that's the first part of the sutra. The second part of the sutra has reflection on the repulsiveness of the body. Reflect on this body hemmed by skin, full of impurity from the soles up, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood." And then it goes on, and if that's not enough, says, "And so go out to the cemetery and do your mindfulness practice in the cemetery and see a dead body, swollen, blue, and festering, thrown into the charnel ground." I don't know anyone, any MBSR teacher, including my sister, who teaches these parts of the Satipatthana Sutra. But it's an integral part of the sutra. We're, you know, it's a serious practice of, we're talking about life and death and what's it all about. It's not a, oh, let's feel better, simply. So Sally says, "When mindfulness practice, an ancient discipline rooted in demanding religious traditions, is appropriated by the New Age, it becomes an exercise in self-satisfaction rather than self-awareness." We need to be careful about that. We need to be careful about that. I quote, she writes so well, I didn't resist quoting her a little bit more. She was at a New Age venue trying to teach a writing workshop, and there were all kinds of other things going on, and she writes, "I'm allergic to phrases like paranormal scanning and discovering your soul mission and to the idea that you can practice telepathy on your pets." She distrusts promises about transformation over the course of a weekend, universal love, universal energy, in surprisingly easy ways to get them. Now, she says, "I believe in things like complete awakening and universal energy, but I also believe in methods that may be easy to learn but are tough to master, and I believe in decades of practice at them, and mindfulness is a perfect example of such a method." And it certainly is. It can be a tremendously rich, deep method. Just don't stop at the surface of what's being taught in the one-weekend workshop of mindfulness. Go further. So deracination, also deracination, it changes the context, it changes the meanings. Remember the four foundations of mindfulness, contemplating the body in the body, etc.? Well, the instructions in the Satipatthana Sutra go on to say, contemplating the body in the body is just the body, not mine, not I, not self, just a phenomenon. Same thing for feelings. We usually say, it's my body, my feelings. We say it's my meditation. And Suzuki Roshi taught us it's a big mistake to think you are the one who's meditating. This is one of those things where if you don't do it, it won't happen. But if you think you're the one doing it, you'll never find your way. That's true. Robert Scharf gives an example of depression. He quotes Brown and Harris, "Hopelessness in the face of loss is the central core of depression." And he quotes another psychiatrist from Sri Lanka saying, "That statement sounds strange to me because as a Buddhist in Sri Lanka, I'd say we're not dealing with a depressive, but with a good Buddhist." It's just that you have to go further and see that the hopelessness is really completely hopeless. And salvation lies in going further and understanding and overcoming that hopelessness. Scharf goes on to say, "Today, Buddhist insight is touted as the antithesis of depression, as a science of happiness. But the early institution in the Buddhist Sangha was a renunciate community. It really required a total life change. And most modern teachers of mindfulness don't require a total life change. They present it as if the therapeutic or liberating benefits don't require dramatic changes in the way one lives. Usually if I'm teaching mindfulness or meditation, I'll say, now be careful with this because it may change your whole life. You may start questioning everything that you're doing and experiencing and going in directions that you weren't expecting to." And that's true. And that's what's wonderful about it. So let's see, secularization, taking mindfulness out of a religious or context. Here's an example. Have any of you who practice mindfulness encountered the metta meditation? May all beings be happy, may they be joyous and live in safety. So wonderful meditation. You can do this for 20 minutes or an hour, or my daughter did this for a whole week at a Vipassana retreat. It's a wonderful meditation. I was actually shocked when I started teaching this to find out how few mindfulness teachers, let alone practitioners, knew the Metta Sutta, the sutra that this comes from. It's short, so I thought I'd show you the whole sutra. And in fact, I'd like us to read it out loud together, if you'd like. Just read along with me. "This is the practice of the one who is wise, who seeks the good and has obtained peace. Let one be strenuous, upright, and sincere, without pride, easily contented and joyous. Let one not be submerged by the things of the world. Let one not take upon oneself the burden of riches. Let one's senses be controlled. Let one be wise, but not puffed up. And let one not desire great possessions, even for one's family. let one do nothing that is mean or that the wise would reprove. May all beings be happy. May they be joyous and live in safety. All living beings, whether weak or strong, in high or middle or low realms of existence, small or great, visible or invisible, near or far, born or to be born, may all beings be happy. Let no one deceive another, nor despise any being in any state. Let none by anger or hatred wish harm to another. Even as a mother, at the risk of her life, watches over and protects her only child, so with a boundless mind should one cherish all living things, suffusing love over the entire world, above, below, and all around, without limit. So let one cultivate an infinite goodwill towards the whole world. Standing or walking, sitting or lying down, during all one's waking hours, let one practice the way with gratitude. Not holding to fixed views, endowed with insight, unburdened by sense cravings, one who is made perfect is liberated from the cycle of creation of suffering for ourselves or others. Just take a moment to tune in to how you feel having read that. Usually when I present this, I get, people respond in one or two ways. Some people go, oh, that's just wonderful. Oh, yes. And other people respond with, I feel terrible. That's overwhelming. I can't possibly do that, and the world won't possibly be like that. Leaving aside which one you're experiencing at the moment, I want to point out that it's not a completely neutral live any way you want. It says, don't take upon yourself the burden of riches. Let your senses be controlled. Don't desire great possessions. Don't deceive another. This is mindfulness. This is mindfulness. It's not just... This is mindfulness, and most important, perhaps, is one word, all. This is applied to every and each person, place, thing one encounters. No exceptions. Doesn't matter what your political persuasion is. May Donald Trump be happy. May Hillary Clinton be happy. May the people of ISIS be happy. May child abusers be happy. May little children be happy. May everyone be happy. No exceptions. It pulls counter to our usual judging, well, this person deserves it and that person doesn't. As soon as you get into deserving, you've got a problem. So there's a religious aspect to this. And if you don't have the religious aspect, you can lose a sense of meaning, especially if you're practicing mindfulness just for your personal benefit. The Tao Te Ching points out, heaven endures forever, earth lasts eternally because they do not live for themselves. The true person doesn't put herself forward. Leaving self behind is at the forefront, and this safeguards true self. Now, we live in a society which puts self pretty high up on be all you can be, maximize yourself, and the thrust of mindfulness practice is to say, together with all beings, I only exist together with all beings. There's a famous quote from Dogen, to study Buddhism, and mindfulness was a Buddha, is a Buddhist practice, to study Buddhism is to study the self, but to study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to realize oneself in all the myriad things everywhere and everywhere. Now, that might sound a little perplexing. How do you forget yourself? But think of the times when you've been involved in a piece of music or a piece of work or making love, and you forget yourself. There's some of the peak experiences, right, is when we forget ourselves and feel connected and embedded in our experience. So Norman Fisher, who some of you might know, Zen teacher, says liberation is liberation from self. And in terms of poetry, and he contributed a poem to the book, liberation would be liberation from self into the poem, into your activity. He wrote a poem, Solitude. I'll just give you the first line. Plants are dreaming of me. There's distance in their dream at whose vanishing point my dream meets theirs. So at this moment, my dream, I hope, may be meeting yours. Maybe we're all dreaming this together. And lastly, instrumentalization, which is taking a spiritual practice and making it into a goal-oriented technique. Got to get calm. Got to get healthy. It's going to get me through my cancer or whatnot. And it locates the value of the activity not in the activity itself, but only in its products and how useful it is. And one of my favorite verses in the Tao Te Ching says, the whole world says my way is great, great but useless. Because it's great, it has no use. If it were useful, it would long have been small. I could explain that more, but our society values usefulness way too much. Children don't worry about being useful. When you retire, are you going to worry about being useful? A lot of people do. I guarantee you that there will be times in your life when you're not useful. I'm sorry, most of you sleep a few hours a night. Useless. Stop sleeping! You need sleep. Sleep is our reminder that being useless is crucial. You'll die if you're not useless part of the time. So, instrumentalization also makes practice into a commodity with a market value. A lot of people are making a lot of money out of mindfulness, and frankly, I think it's something that should be given away free, or maybe it doesn't hurt to take some contributions if people want to support you, but making it into a business, I think, is problematical. And if you practice it from what do I get out of it, that interferes with its fruition. Norman points out, he's got no doubt mindfulness works. He's got a personal experience with it. But if you're very earnest in your effort to practice mindfulness, it can work against you. Just like when you work too hard to try and do something, you get in your own way. What gets crippled in this frantic race towards greater self-realization, efficiency, productivity, focus, is any actual sense of simply being someone. And even the arts and meditation start getting involved. But artists generally practice their art with devotion. We don't talk too much about devotion in the learning and practice and teaching of mindfulness. What are you devoted to? Good question. Good, cute question. So I want to bring up one more issue, which is mindfulness, as it's taught, sometimes confuses the mind of meditation, which we sometimes call the mind of clover, in Robert Aitken's phrase, with the mind of psychology. Now, I'm a psychologist, and there's a lot of good things you can do with mindfulness, and it's helpful. But Buddhists distinguish big mind from little mind. Little mind is composed of thoughts and feelings and sensations and urges. And these are the skandhas in Buddhism. Heaps. just heaps of this, that, and the other, and consciousness itself is one of the skandhas. So in the Abhidharma, they parse big mind into 9 different levels of consciousness, and meditation aims at transformation at the root. To be aware of your thoughts and feelings is like the first shallow level. And if you treat the mind as a psychological entity, it reifies it. It turns it into a graspable thing which turns in on itself. If any of you teach mindfulness, you've probably had people who come to you and say, I don't think I'm very good at mindfulness because my thoughts wander. The problem here is that the Shinshin Ming, faith in mind, advises us seeking mind with the mind is the greatest of all mistakes. So there's a famous, thought that I had another, we'll go right to it. Dogen says, this very mind has thinking, sensing, mindfulness, and realization, and it is free of thinking, sensing, mindfulness, and realization. It's much bigger than we usually think of mind. What's mind? Blues, yellows, reds, and whites are the mind. Long, short, square, round, flowers in space are the mind. Spray of water, foam, and flame are the mind. Each moment is the mind, and yet it can never be broken. It's the mind that can never be broken, which is inherently liberating. So there's a famous Zen koan where Dazu says to his teacher Bodhidharma, Master, I cannot pacify my mind. Please help me. Any meditators here ever felt like that? To which Bodhidharma, in typical Zen fashion, goes, Bring me that mind and I will pacify it for you. To which Dazu says, Oh, I can't. I search for my mind. I can't get a grasp on it. See? Pacified already. The whole point is mind cannot be grasped. That's its liberation. So withered trees are the roots of mindfulness. When we're groping about trying to hit the mark, it's mindfulness. The root of life of all humans on this great earth is the root of mindfulness. There are many people in one moment of mindfulness, many moments of mindfulness within one person. So I'll conclude by saying, as I did in my chapter, what's mindfulness? Nurtured by the continuous mystery of the ordinary and the inexpressible wonder of the mundane, we do not gain anything but awe. We do not lose anything but self-importance. Mind is drinking tea, sweeping the porch, bits and pieces that are undivided and whole in their ordinariness. Body and mind, two sides of the same coin, like the foot before and the foot behind in walking. So in our tradition, we don't practice in order to become enlightened as a way of escaping our problems. Rather, we practice to express the enlightenment that appears as ourself everywhere and every when. You want to see mindfulness and experience it, just look. That's all.
Thank you. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to author Bob Rosenbaum. I do have a couple of questions here. If anyone wants to come up to the mic with a question, please... come up behind me here, and we'll reel them off. Do you meditate?
Do I meditate?
How? How long?
I went to Japan a while ago. I don't know, maybe this was 8 years ago or so, and a person at my home, a home temple associated with my tradition said, oh, you know how to meditate? And I said to him, well, I've been doing it 30 years, so no, I don't know how. And he didn't, he kind of looked at me. I do meditate for about 45 minutes, an hour every morning, and I do about an hour's worth of Qigong. A lot of my friends talk about meditation as flossing. You know, if you don't meditate, the stuff kind of builds up. but I don't take my meditation seriously. It's just central.
Well, this is more about today. Clearly, anyone preaching non-judgment has never made an economic policy decision. How do these teachings apply to leaders and decision makers?
Ah, good question. So I think I indicated there's a way of non-judgment doesn't mean don't discern. So you have to yoke non-judgment with wisdom. But wisdom comes not from a self-centered standpoint. So if you don't judge from a self-centered standpoint, but you try to find what's the thing, in the Tao Te Ching, in the book on walking the way, a lot of people have heard of the Tao, but they don't know what day is, Tao Te Ching. Day is, in a way, it's the judgment aspect of Taoism. It's the way of bringing this universality into the specifics of the moment. It's often translated as power or virtue. I translated it as rightness, to judging to find what fits the situation in a way that there's a harmonious completion. So it's just a little different from the way we usually think of judging as a method of balancing. Parenthetically, if it wasn't Nelson, David Rockefeller kept a very wealthy person. In every office, he had a collection of scales. And people asked him, why do you have the scales? And he said, I keep the scales there to remind me that whenever I make a decision, usually it's about a feather's weight difference between one side and the other.
So you present a very holistic and nuanced perspective of what mindfulness is. And I think then the modern interpretation has been to cherry pick kind of pieces of this, put it in a different context. And there have been some potentially real benefits to
yes.
their bottom line, if it's a company, to health in the medical field. So I'm curious to know what, if any, and in what way do you see these sort of, perhaps, I don't know if cherry picking is the right way, but how might that exist in your view in the company, and what would you want to see, in what way would those things kind of exist?
Well, I'm not sure that I fully understand the question. So in terms of the cherry picking, are you saying in this holistic view, is there a way of cherry picking?
Yeah, so you kind of present like, you know, Google takes one aspect and uses it then for perhaps for their profit, or in the health example, it's just you're using sort of this as breathing techniques that are maybe lowering blood pressure or just sort of other benefits. So it's like these pieces of it are taken and applied.
Yes.
And then it sounds like your argument is, as I understand it, is it should be thought of as more holistically.
Yes.
So what I'm curious to know, is there any place for these sort of just small pieces to be applied and then just forget about everything else? Can that exist?
Oh, I think there's certainly places for the small pieces to be applied, and it can have wonderful, it can be tremendously helpful. But when you choose a piece, don't forget the rest. Know that you're using just a piece. In Buddhism, we talk about skillful means. So you choose one little piece as an entryway, and then let it broaden and broaden. And rather than choose something because it's going to have this effect, choose something because you love it. And you just want to share it and want to have it blossom.
Thank you.
Time for one more question.
In In regard to one of the three main issues with mindfulness, you talked about deracination. I've never heard that word before. I guess it's cultural appropriation.
Yes.
I guess I just didn't really understand why that is a problem.
Well, it's not a problem if one respects the culture. I had never heard of the word either. I had to look it up when I got the chapter from Barry and Mark. I've lived in Japan, and I've lived in India, and I've practiced Qigong, which is a Chinese practice, for 20 years or so. And when I first went to each place, I thought I knew what they were talking about when they presented a practice. And the more I learned of the practice, the more I learned I didn't understand. So as an example, everyone's heard of yin and yang, right? Yang is hard and yin is soft and yang is masculine and yin is feminine. Well, after 20 years of doing Qigong, I'm starting to understand that yin and yang are the same thing with slightly different faces. And just today I was practicing Tai Chi with my sweetheart, and I realized that when my hand was in a yin position, I hadn't completely let it empty out and go to the earth, because I had approached it with my knowledge of this is what relaxation is. But each culture provides us with a window into a whole new world of experience. And so if we don't take the time to appreciate what the culture has to teach us, not just to borrow something, but to really learn from it, we miss out. It's really that simple. We plain old miss out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are we done? Oh, we're done. Oh, actually, no, I want to end with one more thing, as Steve Jobs used to say. So Dogen says, and this is a good way to end mindfulness, mindfulness was originally a way of becoming a Buddha, right? So Dogen said, there's a simple way to become a Buddha. Refrain from unwholesome actions. Don't be attached to birth, life, or death. Be compassionate towards all sentient beings. Respectful to seniors, kind to juniors. Don't exclude or desire anything. Don't have any designing thoughts or worries. And you'll be called a Buddha. Just don't seek anything else. Thanks very much, all of you Buddhas.
What's wrong with mindfulness and what isn't? Zen Perspectives, presented for you today by Robert Meikyo Rosenbaum. And if you would like to hear this again, you can by going to the Commonwealth Club's website, where all of the talks are podcast. And we want to thank Bob for his always insightful and delightful comments today. And we want to thank the audience here, as well as those listening to the recordings. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.